This is the Education Gadfly Show.
There are no stupid questions.
No, there are definitely stupid questions.
Yeah, that was a stupid question. Yeah.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the original Jobs Program, Rick Hess.
Pass this bill, baby. Pass this bill.
So, you know, you are like a jobs program. I mean, I think the AEI education program employs a lot of people, a lot of scholars out there. You're throwing them extra money for chapters and white papers and things like that.
That's true, because universities, man, they're cutting back. Mm-hmm. They're kind of living hand to mouth.
Yep.
You and me, we say, hey, these people deserve to be compensated for their efforts.
You are all into upper middle class subsidies, aren't you? It's like upper middle class welfare.
Well, this is how we have built America in the post-World War II years. Upper middle class subsidies, middle class subsidies, lower middle class subsidies, working class handouts.
Mm-hmm.
A little sweetener for everybody,
subsidize
baby.
Subsidize this, baby.
And you know what the great thing is?
What's that?
The great thing is we don't pay for it. You know who pays for it?
No.
People who aren't around to vote yet.
I know. I love it. What a great deal.
It's you know what it is? It's a Ponzi scheme.
Ponzi.
Or, as the vice president did explain in an interview, he's not sure whether Governor Rick Perry knows who Ponzi was. He was a historical guy. I think he thought that Rick Perry thought, you know, a Ponzi scheme was named after some, like, you know, game by Atari.
I thought he was that guy in Happy Days. What was his name?
No, you're thinking of Potsy or Ralph Mouth.
Yeah, or the Fonz. Okay, so, and there have been some debates on the Republican side. We maybe talk about that a little bit. Not a lot of talk of education yet.
Mm-mm. Nope. Pass this bill, baby.
That's all they're talking about. Pass this bill. By the way, you are not allowed to advocate for or against legislation on the show in order to keep our C3.
Pass this bill.
Which bill are you talking about?
I don't know. That's how I can get away. Did you see that Obama apparently said that 17 times in his address to Congress?
Yeah.
John Stewart was actually incredibly funny with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, in politics, you want to stick to your talking point. But we don't do that here on the show. Let's get started. Intern Laura is here with us, and we're going to play Pardon the Gadfly.
Message, Laura. I care.
Okay, good.
All right.
Love kids. Kids first. Children first.
Thanks, guys. Yep. So this week saw bipartisan support in the House for a new charter school bill. Does this mean that ESEA reauthorization could happen this year?
That would be a no.
Laura, you know, no, of course, Laura doesn't write these questions. Danielle wrote that question. Stupid question. Come on.
There are no stupid questions.
No, there are definitely stupid questions.
Yeah, that was a stupid question.
Yeah. But you know, this is interesting. The vote was something like, I don't know, a whole lot of people to 50. How many representatives do we have these days?
I want to see who. I am curious to see.
130. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of them didn't bother to vote. But what I'm really interested in is to see who the makeup of the no's were.
Well, it was. I asked Sam Dillon at the Times. He was reporting on this. He said it was about 12 Republicans and the rest were Democrats. So I assume the Republicans were way far right, who maybe just don't think that the Fed should be funding education writ large. And yeah, I'd be curious to see which Dems were against it.
I mean, I'm curious if it's folks who are trying to rack up points with the NEA,
or probably.
Is it folk and swing? You know, I'm curious.
Who knows? So yes, they got that piece done. That was not a surprise. Very bipartisan. But look, you know, they've got tougher stuff ahead of them. On the House side, they say they're going to tackle accountability next, and then teacher effectiveness stuff. And those are going to be difficult issues. Not clear how it's going to break politically necessarily or in a partisan way. I think there's plenty of Republicans and Democrats who could see eye to eye on these things. It's really more about the teacher union types on one side, the sort of zealous reform via Washington people on another, and then, you know, the rank and file folks in the middle.
You know, the interesting development was this morning, the Senate Republicans, not the chairman, not the ranking Republican member, but other Republicans, Senators Alexander, Burr, those guys, dropped a package of bills, I guess five bills, which sketch out, parallel actually in largely the House bill on charter schooling, lay out some proposals for flexibility and consolidation of a whole slew of Title II and Title IV programs, offer a dramatically maintain federally required testing in grades 3 to 8, but otherwise dramatically dial back, the NCLB framework, including getting rid of highly qualified teacher provision.
I love that one.
You love the provision, baby?
I hate the provision. I love getting rid of it. So this is, look, I mean, I got to say, I'm pretty happy about this. It tracks pretty well with the vision of reform realism that we've been forwarding for the last couple of years. Not saying it was because of us. I'm just saying that, you know, there's some similar ideas.
Reform realism, Gucci governance. I got a million of these. Hey.
You know, the focus is saying, look, transparency, yes, it's fair to require transparency of all public schools in return for these dollars. Accountability doesn't make sense to try to force that from Washington, except on the very worst schools. And so I think that's something that people can live with. Look, this may come from Senate Republicans, but I will have a hard time thinking up a whole lot of Senate Democrats who would necessarily be against at least big pieces of this bill. They'll get nervous about killing off some programs. There'll be some questions on some of the other pieces here and there. But the basic thing is saying, hey, we're serious about rolling back the federal role to a more manageable size, focusing on transparency, continuing pressure on the very worst schools. Look, I think this is the route to a bipartisan bill.
Pass this bill.
All right. So moving on.
By the way, that should not be viewed as an endorsement of that particular piece of legislation before Congress.
In other news, much ado has been made over recent news that SAT scores for critical reading skills are the lowest in history, and that combined reading and math scores are the lowest since 1995. Is this necessarily a bad thing?
Yes.
What are these questions today, Laura? No. So, no. By the way, if you're asked to read a stupid question, you're allowed to ad lib.
All right, good to know.
Future reference. Okay. Yes, you don't have to stick to the script here. Look, we don't, it's so hard. We don't, SAT, it all depends on who's taking the test. There are more kids taking the test than before, a more diverse group. We also know the demographics in the country have changed over time. Mm-hmm. Many more Latinos than before. They perform worse on average. So it's a little bit hard to know what to make of these national test scores. I get a little annoyed at some of our friends on the reform side who use this kind of evidence to talk about our failing mm-hmm. public schools. Look, NAEP is a more reliable measure than the SAT for that reason.
Oh, absolutely. And no, you're right. I mean, we've had decades of research, right? I was a Powell and Steelman, I guess, back a couple, 20 odd years ago, pointing out that you get a real strong correlation between the percentage of kids in your state who take the SAT and how well you tend to do on the SAT. The better job you do of getting more kids into that pipeline and taking the test, the lower your scores are going to be.
Yeah.
Because the kids you're adding tend to be the kids who are in the middle or bottom of the distribution.
Yeah. I mean, what I'd like to see is for NAEP, for SAT, all these indicators is I would love for someone to dig in and try to look at the impact of the influx of immigration in the last couple of decades and understand how are immigrant kids performing and versus how are the rest of the kids performing. And I think what you would find, we already see that, you know, steady growth in a lot of the demographic categories. I think we would find maybe that's even more impressive story that if you take the immigrant kids out of the picture, which you're going to expect, first generation kids are going to, you know, struggle. On average, we want to help them do more. We want to help them like we did 100 years ago, make the transition. But, you know, but accounting for that, look, there's a good story to tell. And at the same time that, by the way, you know, we've had all these concerns about the child poverty rate increasing, that we've still been able to get better results in our schools.
Well, you know, I mean, especially on this question of illegal immigration, I guess it was Alabama set out last month to try to actually just require schools to identify illegal immigrants in their schools, right? You're still required to educate them. You're not permitted not to. But if I recall, the Washington Post and many of the traditional voices blasted this as, you know, Bull Connor-like tactics, simply to try to find out whether or not whether schools were serving illegal immigrant kids and how many. And I recall hardly any voices besides mine, and I got beat up pretty hard for it, actually saying, gee, maybe it makes sense for Alabama to try to count these kids, because you can't possibly do any of the kinds of research you're talking about unless you first start to identify and count these kids.
Yeah, but if you identify them, then doesn't it drastically increase the likelihood that their parents are going to get kicked out of the country?
Well, maybe.
Topic number three.
In another student shortcoming, New York Times columnist David Brooks reported that this week, young people lack an ability to define and discuss a quote-unquote universal morality. Should we be alarmed by this, and what should we be doing about it?
I don't even know what the hell he means by it, so I have trouble being too alarmed by it.
Well, if you read the article, which I thought was quite good.
I try not to read the New York Times. It just gives me
All right. Even David Brooks.
Oh, my God. You know, the qualification to be a conservative writing on the New York Times is you've got to spend the majority of your time poor-mouthing other conservatives.
Right.
So.
Okay, fair enough. But in this article, he reported on a book that's out that talks a big survey of young people defined as, I think, between about 19 and 23. And it was
whose book is this? Not William Damon's book, is it?
No, not William Damon's. I forget the name of the author. Daniela will try to find it out. Is to look at can young people talk intelligently about issues of virtue and morality, right and wrong? It wasn't about their behavior. It wasn't whether or not they were, you know, going out there having promiscuous sex or not. It wasn't anything like that. But it was, you know, can they talk about just these, you know, commonly held cultural values? And the basic line was no. They, you know, they've grown up in an era where the message has been all values are neutral. You know, it's all about personal preference. You know, basically that, you know, maybe there is no capital R right and capital W wrong. So we just don't want to really talk about it anyways because we don't want to offend anybody. You know, the point is, look,
I certainly totally,
it was Christian Smith, a Notre Dame sociologist. Okay.
I mean, I totally buy that kind of observational critique of what we're doing. Is there any evidence that 18 to 23-year-olds could articulate this stuff coherently 20 or 40 years ago?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And, I mean, plenty of reasons.
I remember when I was 18, I was 18 to 23 in the 80s. Arguably before a lot of the modern push for relativism, I have no confidence that I could have articulated any of that coherently.
Right, and don't even get us started on your behavior back then.
Let's not go there.
So I guess that's a fair point. I mean, my concern is that, I mean, there's the cultural relativism point, and then there's also just the issue of in public schools today, these are the sorts of things that is very hard to do because schools say, look, I've got, you know, all kinds of cultures represented here, diverse population, all kinds of different values. I'm going to just offend somebody if we teach any of this stuff at all, even when it comes to teaching 9/11. How, mm-hmm. you know, are we going to teach about radical Islam and how the people behind that wanted to, you know, bring America down and they're a bona fide enemy? All this stuff. Well, no, we don't want to offend anybody. You know, so they end up just ignoring these topics. Mm-hmm. And one of the great benefits of
schools, or even worse, doing this mealy-mouthed kind of warm, they don't ignore it,
yeah.
but they give you these cleaned up McDonald's, yeah. you know, yeah. Happy Meal versions
right.
of it.
And let's just talk about being tolerant and let's peace and
it's well, just nobody's a part fault. Of it, but it was 19 guys unrelated right. to any country or
right.
philosophy or ideology on earth.
Right. So, you know, if you're in a school of choice, certainly a private school, but maybe also a charter school, other schools of choice, you know, and the school is founded around a set of values that people buy into, then you have more leeway to teach from a specific position, you know, to have a more clear moral voice on issues like this.
So does this, Kristen Smith, I mean, is there anything in this book which actually compares 18 to 23-year-olds who've come out of private school, for instance, or coherent curricular programs as opposed to others?
David Brooks did not report that, but we will look into it.
Not surprised. I mean, that is the kind of stuff that would actually impress me. That would be really interesting.
Rick.
But I'm not surprised the New York Times skipped past it.
So, Rick, you say Rick Hess is right and the New York Times is wrong. That's the right and wrong of Rick Hess. All right. Boom, boom. Okay, that's all the time we got for Part in the Gadfly. Thanks for playing. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Next time, remember, you can feel free to change the questions if Daniela writes dumb
Although, to be fair, Mike, if she does change a tag question, you'll be, Laura, what the hell are you doing? You didn't tell me you changed the question.
That is probably true. Okay, it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, Amber, I heard you had a little bit of a shoe bomber incident this morning.
I did. One of my favorite pairs of shoes, the entire bottom just flip-flopped off while I was walking to the metro this morning.
Could you say that it exploded off?
It sort of kind of did. And then, you know, it was just embarrassing. And then I was just like, oh, no, what am I going to do? I don't have any other shoes to match. Am I going to drive all the way home to Germantown when I'm already at the metro station? It was just a dilemma.
What'd you do?
So I'm wearing my gym shoes today with my skirt. And I'm just very self-conscious. Just about it, people. Just
Amber came in, weird. And the first thing she did was send an email to the whole office explaining why she was wearing tennis shoes. I assume that message was meant for probably the female staff of the
office.
But
it gets on my
nerves. Most of the men would not have noticed.
When women wear tennis shoes with skirts, even though in D.C. we do it a lot because we walk a lot and all that, but I still just don't
really
like it.
Even if they get to the office and change, is that okay?
Yeah, that's okay.
I don't think we need this kind of judgmentalism. Mike's all into arbitrary right and wrong, but me, if they're comfortable shoes,
it's all okay.
If they if there are shoes to keep your feet, you know, warm and let you do your job, that's good enough.
I thought that might come from you, just guessing. But.
See, when there was a time there when I was working at the Department of Education, and let's just say the fashion standards weren't terribly high, that I was walking a mile to the metro, and I decided it would be a good idea to get these kinds of walking shoes that looked kind of like dress shoes, and so I could wear them, you know, I could walk to the office in them, until my wife just totally berated me for, you know, having no dignity whatsoever to walk in these loafers that look like they were made for, you know, 70-year-olds.
And part of your role at the department, Mike, was to lift the sartorial.
And let me tell you, I think I did that. It was not hard to do. And no offense to my people at the Department of Ed. It's just, you know, it's just not part of the culture to be snazzy dressers. Although there is a strange cultural thing over there, which is that all the political appointees basically wear suits every day. And all the career, most of the career staff do not. And so it's like very obvious walking around.
That's right.
Who's who? Okay.
Lots of banter. I don't know today. We might have to be editing this. We'll see.
Okay. So Amber, what great research study are we talking about today?
Not a great research study today.
Oh, are you going to go after somebody?
I'm going after somebody. Yes. The new report from Third Way. This is a think tank that few people had heard of until a study of theirs appeared in the Wall Street Journal this week. Analysts use NAEP data and schools' participation in the federal free and reduced price lunch program to draw three simple conclusions. Number one, most American students attend middle class schools. Number two, middle class schools spend less per student and have a greater student teacher ratio than wealthy and lower income schools. And three, middle class students are underperforming on tests. All right, there they are. However, the use of middle class is not accurate. They define middle class as a school with between 26 and 75% of its students on free and reduced price lunch. That's a pretty broad range. So we can safely assume that these are economically diverse schools. We don't have individual student level data here on income or on achievement, so we don't know how many kids are truly middle class. There's also an assumption that the low achieving, that low spending in middle class schools, which is about 10,000 or more, and the high student teacher ratios at 17.5 to 1 are problems, as if increasing funding and class size are the answer. Finally, I don't like how the report was presented. The entire methodology is presented in footnotes, 95 footnotes and a short 15-page report, so it's really hard to figure out exactly what they went about analyzing and doing.
Okay, two questions. One, so it said 26 to 75% of the students in these schools were on free and reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. So that means that middle class in America is a community that 50% free and reduced lunch?
Well, that's the question. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
We actually do know this, right? We know what percentage of American children are free and reduced lunch, and it ain't 50%.
Well, it's close. It's like 40% or
yeah,
so.
That's substantially short of 50.
But the point is, we don't actually know the income level of the kids in these schools.
That's right.
They could be, you know, could be that 50% of the kids are super rich kids and 50% of the kids are super poor kids.
Right.
Well, and none of them are middle class.
But in what sense do they say they're underperforming?
They're underperforming on NAEP.
In relative terms of, to what?
Relative to low achieving. I mean, low, what are they? There's three categories, like low poverty and high poverty. Yeah, so it really makes absolutely no sense.
Who wrote this thing for Third Way?
Third Way, Tess Stovall and Deirdre Dolan.
Have you ever heard of these guys?
No.
Yeah. Maybe they're undergrads. I'll feel for them.
So, because, you know, the premise would be interesting. I mean, really, my ears perked up. I said, oh, my gosh, did somebody was able to somehow get data on the actual income level of individual kids and figure out, okay, maybe in these schools, you know, so many percentage of the kids had to be between these, you know, between 30 and 80,000 family income. And we're looking at, I mean, that would be very interesting. Mm-hmm. That is not what we have here, people. Feel bad. I feel personally responsible for this debacle.
Why?
Well, Stephanie Banchero at the Wall Street Journal was trying to get a hold of me last week, and I was not available, and I probably could have killed the whole thing.
Oh,
I mean, and told
her
these are not middle-class schools. These are diverse schools.
Yeah.
And the Third Way thing, look, I assume that their case that they're trying to make is let's not just focus on inner-city schools.
Right,
let's focus on suburban schools, too, which is fine. But come on, people. You need some help.
Yeah, they need some help.
Maybe it sounds like maybe it's a couple of undergrads that wrote it for a college paper. Somebody told Third Way about it, and they published it.
Maybe. I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, gosh, I got a lot of a lot of play and, really? And Wall Street Journal and
because the headline's great. Middle class schools. I mean, that's interesting.
Right. Like, oh, finally people finally suburban parents are going to think their schools don't deserve an A or a B, you know.
Yeah, but there you have it. All right. So what song goes along with this sucky song?
Since we're talking about middle schools, sort of, kind of.
Middle class schools.
Right. Middle class schools. We got Stuck in the Middle by Steeler's Wheel. Mm. It's a good song.
Yes.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you. And I'm wondering what it is I should do. It's so hard to keep the smile from my face. Losing joy, I'm all over the place. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Well, you started out with nothing and you found that you're a sucker.
Rick, you were saying that song was in a famous movie scene.
It was in Tarantino's breakthrough film.
Reservoir Dogs. And what was happening during the scene?
It was stuff that our listeners probably don't want to hear.
Oh, okay. Well, people
graphic
have to check that
violence.
Out. Graphic violence. All right, hey, speaking of graphic violence, it's time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes, sir.
So, I mean, Chris, I don't know that it's... you sometimes have graphic violence on the show. Is this what we're talking about today?
Well, I wouldn't call this graphic violence, but it's, you know, in the violence category.
Oh, good. Okay, what you got?
Well, having a school police officer is supposed to give that school's employees, students, and parents peace of mind, knowing that a responsible officer of the law is around to ensure safety and security. This apparently was not the case in Los Angeles, though, where Officer Jeff Stenroos was this week found guilty of felony counts on four crimes after fabricating a story back in January that a ponytailed burglary suspect had shot him in his bulletproof vest. In a desperate attempt for fame and to go on medical leave, he fired a bullet into his own protective vest, planted a shell casing, and repeatedly gave false accounts of what happened. His initial report prompted a 10-hour lockdown of over 9,000 students at local area schools, while police delayed traffic in search of a suspect across an 8-square-mile area in the San Fernando Valley. Seriously, officer? What's up with that? In a time when cities are laying off police officers and new ones are having an incredibly difficult time finding a job, what was this guy thinking when he pulled this stunt? It's not like he was on the beat in Compton. He was a school police officer in the Valley. How much less stressful do police jobs get? And if you're going to try a scam like this, be man enough to follow through with it. In a 2-hour interview with police after the event, he went from spinning lies about how painful getting shot was and swearing before God about the incident to outright recanting and admitting fabricating the story. This guy not only prompted a 10-hour lockdown at the schools, but he left the school district on the hook for some $57,000 in medical expenses and continued to receive full pay while on medical stress leave. Schools are already hurting enough for cash without boneheaded idiots like this guy trying to make a cash grab for fame in one foul swoop.
You know, that is the message we have for criminals today. Before you act, think about the impact on our state budgets, okay? Mm. We do not have the money right now for a frivolous crime like this.
Man, I hope they go after this guy. I hope they foreclose on his house. I hope they sell his TV. I hope they take every bloody nickel until they've made full restitution on that.
Was he in the jacket when he fired at it?
Yes.
Really?
Oh, really?
That's what they
he
say.
He really was?
Yeah.
He, wow. Like pointed the gun a foot away from himself?
I guess so.
Himself and
You got to have a lot of faith in the Kevlar, don't you?
I was going to say, that's intense.
Well, I think
he like hung it on a wall and shot at it.
That's
or
what
something.
I was thinking.
They make all these guys go through and like experience it, don't they, in their training? At least that's what I was under the impression.
They shoot at them? You mean while they're wearing the vest?
Yeah.
Really?
Maybe not. I could be wrong. I haven't had police training.
I don't have much experience with Kevlar vests myself.
That's, God, what a schmuck.
Mm. Yeah.
Are there more schmucks like that today than there once were because of all the opportunities or for fame? Or is it just because with national media that you hear about the schmucks wherever they happen to be?
We need a longitudinal study on that one.
Yeah.
That would be very helpful.
Oh. Yeah.
You know, look, when you said that people have a peace of mind when there's a police officer in the school, I just don't buy that either. I mean, number one, that's a sign that something's wrong with that school, right? Or at least that you're nervous about something. Number two, I don't want some rent-a-cop guy with a gun in the school. That's how I feel about that.
Well, they're real police officers. It's not like it's some mall rent-a-cop. I mean, they come from the local district, assuming, you know, I mean, this is, I mean, my experience was it at my high school, and we were a pretty well-to-do district. It was one of America's private public schools, according to Fordham, and we still had a local police officer in the building, and I mean, there were never any serious issues with crime or anything like that.
You don't really need the cops assigned. I mean, one of the innovative programs that I've read about, I think from New Zealand, is what they do is they put out a large tray of donuts outside the school entrance during the academic day, and apparently it's like a bird feeder. Everything else just works out.
And, New Zealand, you said.
And the latest great policy idea from Rick Hess with a global angle, too. Well, that is unfortunately all the time we got for this week. But if you stayed through to the end, you got a real nugget of wisdom here. Loving it. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.